I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, welcome to Plant Yourself. I'm your host, Howard Jacobson. Two quick announcements before we get to today's show. If you're interested in becoming a health coach, I'm offering another run due to popular demand for people who can't make 8 p.m. on Wednesday nights, Eastern Time. So we're doing another run of the program, which will meet, the practicums will meet at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, Eastern Time, U.S., which means if you're in Europe or Africa, that might be good for you. Also, if you're in the U.S. and evenings aren't good and you have free time in the mornings, either 7 a.m. Pacific time or 10 to 11:30 Eastern, then you can participate. If you want to find out more about becoming a wicked effective health coach, you can go to wellstartcoach.com. Second thing is, if you're not aware of it, Josh Lajani and I have a book that is free on Amazon Kindle. It's called Sick to Fit. And if you just go to Amazon and search for Sick to Fit, you'll be able to download it for free and read it on any Kindle-enabled device, even a phone, smartphone, tablet, computer, whatever. All right, let's get to today's episode. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com, WellStart Health, and the Big Change Program. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live a happy and humble life. Humble, because today's guest, Brian Wansink, will convince you that humility is the only way we can approach ourselves, our foibles, and our incredible ability to be influenced by our environments without knowing it, realizing it, or admitting it. Brian is the author of a couple of very well-known books, including Mindless Eating and Slim by Design. I was introduced to Brian by my friend and podcast guest, Russ Lahamidou. And initially, I wasn't sure that Brian was going to be a good fit because he's actually appeared in a Got Milk commercial with the milk mustache. And he hasn't done very much work at all on quality of food. He's really focused on quantity. But you know what? Those of us in the plant-based community also struggle with quantity, with overeating, with eating when we're not hungry, and of course, with eating foods that we'd rather not eat, whether they're fully plant-based and they're just calorically dense, or whether they're vegan junk food, or whether we actually stray and cross the line into mainstream crap. So there's a lot of wisdom that Brian has to offer, and I wanted to explore it with him. Now, one thing that I've been hearing the last couple of years, actually, is there's a lot of talk about his studies not being replicatable and about some questionable study design. And we didn't get into that too much during our conversation, partly because I didn't want to make that the focus. And if we just talk about it for a couple of minutes, it's too easy for his detractors to kind of take things out of context. But we did discuss kind of the basics of what makes good study design. And I have to say, I was quite convinced when Brian was talking about the naturalism of his studies. In other words, not just giving somebody a plate of food and observing them like a bunch of scientists, but having people sit down at Four Tops with three other people where they could make conversation, actually having conversation prompts, doing things that may have made the study harder to replicate, because obviously you can't replicate the exact same conversation between four strangers, but also making it much more relevant and useful and applicable to our everyday lives in which we're not scientific subjects of study, but we're ordinary people eating food in ordinary places and conducting other ordinary business at the same time. So through our conversation, you'll discover a whole bunch of really simple things that you can do to increase the odds that you will eat the way you want to eat, the amount, the speed, the quality, the timing of the food that you put into your mouth. And the beautiful thing about it is once we set up the environment, we don't have to think about it. And so we don't even realize that we're being influenced by it. We're just going about our day the same as we always do. Okay, three quickie announcements before we get to our conversation. First one is there is a new transcript up of my interview with Dr. Walter Longo. Thanks very much to Kelly Machia for doing that transcript, which you can find as PDF or inline at plantyourself.com/269. Second thing, as many of you know, the Big Change Program has merged into Well Start Health, and we're running another cohort starting on October 1st. If you're interested in getting to your ideal weight, in dropping diseases, in feeling better, in reclaiming your life, you can check us out at wellstarthealth.com/program, where you can read all about it and apply. And third announcement, we are running another cohort of the Coach Training Program. It's been so successful. We've got so many great testimonials, which you'll be able to check out quite soon, as soon as we get the website up and running. If you're interested right now, email me, hj@plantyourself.com, and let me know you'd like to become a WellStart coach, and I will add you to the notification list. Okay, now it's time to find out how we can use mindless eating to our advantage. Brian Wansink, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Howard. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, so I've been following your work for a long time. I was utterly fascinated by your book, Mindless Eating, as much by the research methods as the conclusions. And you know, I loved how these your insights were adopted so readily by some of the most admired companies in America as sort of an 80-20, right? New health and nutrition are so complex, so multifactorial. And they said, here's a thing we can do. So that was kind of my introduction to your work. But I'd love for you just to tell us a little bit about yourself, your research background, and kind of what led you to look at this idea of mindless eating and quantity and an environment as a huge determinant of our behavior.
Well, sure. I grew up in Iowa and, I grew up kind of selling vegetables door to door and things like this. So I've always been very, very interested in food and the practical thing about getting people to consume them. The crazy thing about fruits and vegetables, for instance, just as an example, is that you can have an entire little wagon as an 8-year-old boy selling these things, and one house will buy every single thing you have, and the next house looks at you like, there's kryptonite something in your wagon. And so clearly there's something going on that isn't just about education or about social demographics, but there's something else that goes on that kind of explains why we like the foods we eat and why we eat those. So it created this entire long road of studying what are the psychological factors, the behavioral factors that influence our eating that we're not aware of, because those are the things that we can probably change very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So you were selling vegetables door to door, like you had a family farm or a stand and you were just pulling.
I was dragging them by. Yeah. It's kind of a funny image, but this is also back in the late 1960s where, there were sidewalks and there were neighbors and things like that. So
that's fascinating that you, at some point, I don't know if it was when you were 8 or much later, that you saw that, the differences in people's attitudes towards your little cart of produce varied, even though probably everyone went to the same church, the same school, the same civic events, the same county fairs.
Same education.
Yeah, when was the first time that you began to be curious about, what are the differences?
Oh, what's interesting is when I was in my master's program, mass communication and journalism, and interviewing people, you'd be asking these questions. And journalism is really one type of journalism is mainly kind of psychology. And so I really started saying, wow, segment differences, what could they possibly be? Because I know they're not demographic.
Uh-huh.
And I know they're not education. So what could they possibly be? And so that's what started then this whole sort of thing. And it's why mindless eating eventually came up, because I started doing all these experiments that said, wow, there are just wacky small things that influence people to eat a little bit more, or to pick up the thing on the left versus the right, or to like a food more than the person sitting right next to them. There's little bitty things that influence those attitudes and behaviors. And if we know what those are, we can set up our entire environment so that we eat a little bit better, we eat a little bit less, we like certain foods more, or, you know, the guests who come over to our dinner like our food more. And that they're so simple to change. You don't have to go to Le Cordon Bleu to become a chef. You don't have to get a PhD in nutrition, or you don't have to go in on these horrible deprivation diets where I'm never going to eat cheese again, or, you know, I'm going to give up pizza for the rest of my life. You don't have to do that stuff. They're smaller, easier. As you mentioned, 80-20 things that you can do that can make a big difference.
Right. Of course, I don't feel deprived by not eating cheese. I would feel deprived if I had some. I know what you're saying. I think, you know, Russ and I are going to try to tag team on you to. I remember when I started reading some of the psychology on how easy it is to change people's behaviors without their knowing. There was nothing about food in that early literature. I remember one study, I think out of Franklin and Marshall, that had people, it was like early 70s, and they were looking at like what makes people do good deeds. And they found that if somebody like walked past the phone booth and dug their finger in the coin return slot and found a dime, they were like twice as likely to help someone who dropped a package of file folders. And I remember reading this stuff and going, oh my gosh, like my free will is a total illusion. I am so easily manipulable. What did you start seeing in the literature? Was it, you know, the early behavioral economists, or like what made you think that the subconscious or the things we don't notice could have such a huge impact on our behaviors?
Yeah, that's interesting. With the literature would be social psychology, but I think what it largely became is that I would do all these crazy studies and things would come out wrong, or they'd be a whole lot different than what they're supposed to be. And I'd try to figure out why was that. And it's like, oh, well, one explanation could be that this study was done at night and this one was done in the afternoon, but why would the night be different than the afternoon? And it created almost sort of a bottom up sort of thing that just by looking at data and going, whoa, holy cow, that's a difference I would have never guessed. That thing started sort of kind of bubbling to the top. But I think that you bring up a cool point in that, a lot of the early stuff that looked at subconscious influences was often done in a fairly abstract way. And all of mine is just specifically focused on food, which makes kind of things interesting is that, and that's kind of unusual in academia that, that a person's focuses on super practical solutions. Usually things are a little bit more theoretical. And I think it led somebody, this might have been 4 or 5 years ago, to kind of come up to me one time and says, do you know what you are? You're a pracademic. I think the guy meant it derisively or something. Yeah. I'm like, wow, that is great. I love that word. Yeah. That's me. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Unfortunately for your bank account, most of the things you invented are things that are actually going to make us fat. Right, like the endless soup bowl. Can you tell us? I was so struck when I read that. Like, I wanted one. Like, can you talk about like how that came about? What it is?
A little bit of background is that up to that point we'd been finding all these crazy things that caused people to eat too much, like, you know, the size of a plate or the size of a package. If you have a bigger plate, for instance, you end up pouring about 20% more food on it. But you don't know you're doing that because it's the surface area is so huge. You know, people pour more out of big cereal boxes and smaller cereal boxes. We found all these things. But what we were running into was people, you know, we'd publish these papers and say, hey, look, so the solution is use smaller plates or, you know, pour out of smaller containers or serve in smaller containers or whatever. And people would say, well, you know, I know you found that, but I know when I'm full. So that would never influence me. And so, and in one study, we ended up looking at French versus Chicagoans as to how they determined their dinner was over. Okay. And we asked them a bunch of questions. And basically, the French would say, you know, I know my dinner is over when I'm no longer hungry or the food no longer tastes good. I mean, those are like internal cues, you know, your tummy or your tongue that you're through eating. But the Chicagoans we looked at were more likely to say, I know I'm through eating dinner when the plate's empty or when the TV show I'm watching is over. And those are like external cues to stop eating. And it made us say, well, what would happen if your bowl never ended? If it never emptied, would you just keep like eating like kind of the family dog until you blew up? And so what we did was I did a couple different studies and found that, yes, you would. But to do it in a way that was kind of very vivid, we created this a refillable soup bowl. And it's we had three different tables, and these tables had big 6-quart cauldrons of soup that had tubes running underneath them and connected to soup bowls. There's holes drilled in the table that you wouldn't see. And we found that when people came down and started eating soup, if their soup bowl refilled, they'd eat about 73% more soup, but they wouldn't realize they had done it. They'd rate themselves just as full and everything. And, you know, the big point behind that was to communicate to people, mainly kind of academics, that yes, you may say that something like the size of a plate or the size of a package or what the person's doing next to you, you know, won't influence how much you eat because you know when you're full. However, in this entire study, nobody realized they were full because they'd used their eyes, not their stomach.
Uh-huh. Well, this reminds me of something that I came across a little while ago about these like sommeliers and wine experts who were like almost entirely fooled into thinking that white wine was red wine because they added food coloring.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? Yeah, I did something on a TV show like Mind Games or Headspace or something like that, and we did a bunch of little studies like that, and that's one of the things that we did is something analogous to that.
So I'm just really curious about like how you go about. You have this idea for refillable bowls. Just from a practical standpoint, how do you find engineers to do this? Do you go down to your auto mechanics shop and say, hey, do you have some tubes and compressors? Like, I wouldn't even know. Like, how do you begin to think about constructing something as diabolical as a never-ending soup bowl?
that's a great question, and actually, I appreciate the opportunity to answer it because that was particularly perplexing because I had this idea and was designing it, and I found a little restaurant that let this happen and stuff, and I couldn't get it right. And I worked with this other guy, and we just couldn't figure it out. We'd have soup that was like spurting up in people's faces, and then go up or down or gurgle. In fact, you know, here's how much of an idiot that a lot of initial efforts are in research. And actually, there's a funny expression that they said, if we knew exactly what the answer is going to be, we wouldn't call it research. Uh-huh. But what the idea we were doing, all these things I couldn't get to figure out. And then I realized what the problem was as you were using chicken noodle soup, like the chicken and the noodles were plugging up the tube. So I'm like, oh, okay. So we went to tomato soup, but I still couldn't get it figured out. And you know, I did a crazy thing. I went and I found a undergraduate. So at the time, I was a professor at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, which is a crazy great engineering program. And I went to some undergraduate in I think it's fluid mechanics or fluid mechanic engineering or something like that. And said, like, you know, basically give pizza and Mountain Dew if you could help me figure it out. Done. And he did it in, like, I don't know, 2 hours. Oh, gosh.
So one of the tricks was not having chunky things that we're gonna.
Yeah. And another thing was asking a smart engineering undergraduate student to figure it out.
Uh huh. Okay. So then the setup was, so people come and they're sitting down at the table and there's the soup bowl, and do they think it's weird that the bowl is, like, bolted to the table, or?
Oh. Yeah, no, they would. And in fact, in some of the initial pilot studies that they did, so what I ended up doing is drilling a bigger hole in the table, like maybe about this size.
Uh-huh.
And there's the tube that went into the bowl was flush mounted to the bottom of the bowl. And so they could actually move it around a little bit,
okay.
And not see anything strange going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think we kind of told people ahead of time too, something along the lines of something like, hey, we're trying to keep things kind of neat and clean here, you know. So just kind of the table's set pretty nice. So just don't mess anything up.
Uh huh. Okay.
It wasn't bowl specific, but it was enough. Mm-hmm. Think of a prompt. There were only a couple people who actually kind of figured out anything was going on. One guy tried to pick it up. So.
Okay. So then you found people ate almost twice as much soup from the same bowl when it was, now it was like slowly refilling to the point where they didn't really notice?
Not at all. You would never, ever see it refill. Yeah.
Which is amazing in and of itself. Like, that people wouldn't notice. Were you worried before you started testing this that people would go, hey, what's going on?
Initially. And so, but the thing is, you realize that we, as people, we are so easily influenced by things. And we said, so what could we do that's natural that would get people to not realize anything's going on or not focus on the book? Well, the first thing is you don't have them eat alone. In a lot of studies, they put people alone in a cubicle and they study something, and there's somebody's like looking at them being filmed. And, and so this is set up like a restaurant. It was a four people sitting at the table. And so we did that a few times, and we realized that sometimes it became kind of awkward because if the people didn't know each other, they'd kind of eat and kind of just eat. So what we did then was we said, okay, now let's try this. Let's go to people, and when they're doing this, say a couple different things. I think we asked them about what we'd like you to do is kind of just talk about what your plans are for like Christmas vacation or for a summer vacation they're planning or something like that. Because this study went on for a long time.
Uh-huh.
But once you get somebody to talk about what they did for vacation or what they're going to do for vacation, you know, they get engaged and they start talking about that like normal people would, and they're not stealing it.
Uh-huh.
And it's much more natural. It's much more, it's much more natural to, eat with other people and eat in these situations than to just do so in a, you know, lab in a basement somewhere. So, I mean, it's interesting. About a year and a half ago, a couple of critics came after me and said, oh my gosh, your field studies are so loose. They're so crazy. You know, there's all these little problems with them and stuff. And the nice thing about field studies is it shows something works in a real life. But then also the nice thing is that almost everything we've done has been redone in labs and other situations. You know, and it shows that a lot of these findings are really robust, but they are particularly strong when you get real people in real situations.
Uh-huh. In other words, this works in practice, but does it work in theory?
That's right. Well, it works in practice, but it works in real places even better than it does in artificial places.
Right.
So, which is what most of us are doing here.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you call your book Mindless Eating, which brings people to think about, okay, so now what I have to do in order to overcome is I have to sit down and be a monk and breathe and like put down my fork between every bite. But you're not saying that we have to somehow like overcome our natural impulses to be social, to enjoy each other's company. You're saying that that because we are mindless eaters, we can take some steps, environmental steps, that can protect us when we don't have the mindfulness to protect ourselves, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because the thing is, if you can be mindful and, you know, focus on the pee and enjoy the flavor and things like this, that is incredible because you'll love food more, you'll eat less. In most studies, it's a great way to do that. And it works for 5 or 10% of the population. But for the rest of us, I don't think our lives would even really allow it that well because we're coming home and, you know, the kids are screaming. We've got a big to-do list. There's a telemarketing phone call. The dog has to go out. You know, and for us to eat the pee with our eyes closed is just not going to work for us. So we have to come up with another solution. And I believe that the easy sort of 80-20 solution for a lot of people is to just set up their environments and use some of these rules of thumb so they can mindlessly eat less and still enjoy the people around them, still enjoy the food, still not have to, you know, move to, you know, and live the life of an aesthetic.
Right. So, but, right. Cause, you know, I have subscribed to that and every so often I would have this like, okay, I'm going to eat mindfully from now on. And then like 2 days later, I'd find myself like pacing. I'm not even sitting down at a place setting.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought, oh, like I failed again. As opposed to like make, you know, setting the table every day. So like, oh, that's the nicest place to eat and kind of looking out the window and not having the TV on or the radio on and just removing some of the distractions that otherwise I'm powerless to resist.
Yeah. You know, in so many cases when people start this to make a change in their life, they often go through this deprivation dieting. And it's kind of the sort of thing where they say, I'm not going to eat X, Y, or Z. And those are X, Y, or Z. There's a reason to eat those because they love those foods. And those sort of diets, you know, they might work for a little while, but at some point, it's just depriving yourself of anything you really, really love, whether it's food or TV or affection or music or whatever, just comes back to blow up. But like you also said, and I think this is interesting, is that when people try to make changes, they often try to do too much. In fact, the last chapter in Mindless Eating looks at the idea that when we give people even the three changes that we know behaviorally are going to make the most difference in their specific life, in their specific situation, their specific problems, even three changes is way too much for most people. And most people can handle about one at a time. And then if they can do that for a while, eventually 2, 3, 4 weeks later, when they start seeing a little bit of change, it can then trigger other changes, but to not start off very large at all.
Right. And I find most people don't have the self-confidence that they can change at all because they've tried to, you know, bite off more than they could chew or not bite off less than they could chew. Like, okay. Yeah. And so they think of it in terms of deprivation. And so there's always a blowback and there's always their own experience is, yeah, I'm going to try again, but this doesn't work. Whereas if you give people the smallest possible change to make and they discover that, oh, they can do it because it's so small, it's not even a big deal. Like I'm going to use the 9-inch instead of the 11-inch plate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or I'm going to serve, I'm not going to have any serving bowls on the table unless it's salad. Uh-huh. I'm going to serve all my meat and potatoes off of a side counter. You know, even that's something, even the person with the least discipline in the world can say, you know, I think I can do that. I can just, I'll just leave the chicken and the pasta over on the counter.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
More, go back and get it.
Right. And we, you know, I think, I can't remember who talked about like the 20 second rule, which is if like something is 20 seconds worth of inconvenient, yeah, probably going to let it go. Whereas if it's right, like 20 seconds is enough to stop you from doing most things.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, and what you touch on, which is really interesting, is that something needs to be super, super simple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is kind of funny. This is this might've been about a few years ago. This is a little bit after Mindless Eating came out, but just before Slim by Design came out, somebody called a reporter called and said, "Hey, you know, can I get your thoughts on this? I think it might've been a study that was done or something that showed that if a person was eating and after every time they took a bite, they set their fork down and counted to like 10. Okay. And then, you know, took another bite, that they would eat a lot less food." I thought, yeah, I'm positive they will. That one meal, they're just never going to do it a second time. Who in the world is going to put a fork down and count to 10 after every minute? You know, just, that's sort of the forever alone kind of person.
Well, you know, that's exactly what I would do. Like, I would go to these like meditation or self-development retreats. And after the morning, I'd be like, I am such a spiritual person. And I would sit there and I would, you know, and I would like be so self-conscious of being natural that I just felt like the most fake person in the world. Like, this is so not who I am. You know,
sit
and smile and smell the food.
Yeah. Oh, and I wasn't seeing anything bad about meditation or anything like that. In fact, I, you know, meditate a little bit every morning, but just about the idea of just being a little bit, you know, too extreme with things. Yeah, because in certain studies, those things are extreme and they work, but that's why they're not done in field situations, because, you know, you never get anybody the second time.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, meditation is about trying to come to a natural state of being. Like, for me, living in this modern world where there's always, you know, telemarketers and screaming babies and dogs and bills to pay, like, that's not what I evolved for, right? Like, I evolved to, like, you know, dig up roots and protect my family from animals and build huts and, like I can handle that. And so to become, like, instead of me trying to adapt to this world, to do what you suggest and to make these simple one-time decisions that then allow me to protect myself.
Yeah, and it's funny. I like the idea of we're probably better built to not meditate, but to be walking around the neighborhood with a spear. I mean, it's probably more along the lines of what we're.
Yeah, I mean, like I'm sure at night we'd light the fire, we watch the sun go down. We would naturally meditate because like these vistas would induce it, right? Like, you know. You just want to sort of, you know, you're in a beautiful nap, you're sitting by the beach, you're watching the waves, you're like, oh, I just want to sit and not think for a little while, like, as opposed to turn it into this really unnatural process that has to, like, overcome all of my human impulses for like, keeping busy.
That's right. That's good.
So what are you working on now? I know you've done a lot of sort of consulting for like Google. I remember I went out to the Googleplex and they showed me like your influence, like, you know, they didn't mention you by name, but they go like, and here's our small plates. Cause we took M&Ms out of the line of the cafeteria. I'm like, oh, that's Wansink's work.
Yeah. Right?
So are you still working with organizations? Are you, what's your latest,
So a lot of bigger organizations and trying to develop or developing for them plans, helping them implement plans that can change, for instance, all of their cafeterias so they all guide people to make healthier choices. Even though the same indulgent foods are there, it guides people to take an apple instead of cookies. And you know, we've already done this with 29,000 schools in the United States. We call it the Smarter Lunchroom Movement. So if you go into one of those schools, you know, you'll find that the healthiest entree is always first. What they cue and what they advertise are the healthiest stuff is the specials, because that triggers people to be more likely to be healthy. Even if they don't get the special, they get healthier subsequent things. It's changed the way milk's sold and things like this. And it's a really cool program. It's a free program. That's why there's 29,000 schools using it.
Gotcha. So I remember reading, I think it might have been in one of Kelly McGonigal's books, maybe The Willpower Instinct, where she talked about like blowback. Like when McDonald's added salads to their menu, it actually increased the consumption of like burgers and fries and shakes because people looked at the salad and like convinced themselves that they had already had it by just considering it. So have you, how does the smarter lunchroom movement deal with the idea of like, okay, there's a healthy thing, so now I'm off the hook?
Oh yeah, because it doesn't change the foods. The same foods are being offered, but what it does is just sets things up so people unknowingly get guided toward picking up an apple instead of the cookie they do. And that's the key is being mindless, because once it becomes mindful, people kind of say, okay, I need to reward myself. And that's what causes this blowback. But if they don't realize that they were influenced in the first place, there's nothing to reward yourself for. Because they're like, yeah, I just picked up an apple. Why? I don't know. I just felt like it. So they didn't consciously make that effort and say, now I need a good boy reward.
So that just brought up, that kind of blew my mind, just what you just said, because like philosophically, it raises a really thorny issue of like, you know, free will, right? Like if people are being being guided to eat healthier and it works when they don't even know it's happening, which is like totally makes sense to me. Like if I feel like I'm being influenced, right? Like, you know, as I was in sales for a long time, we used to say people love buying, they hate being sold to. And it's sort of the same thing. Like nobody wants to be influenced. Like was that kind of a key tenet of the whole project?
Yeah, it's consistent with it. It's just the whole thing of just not giving people the opportunity to reward themselves. And they don't feel they need to reward themselves if they don't think that they did something healthy. They just did what they wanted to do. And the fact it happened to be something healthy, it's like, well, I don't know. You know, I didn't use my own volition to do that. It just seemed good. So that's what seems to work really well for a lot of us. And the environment's going to influence you one way or the other, regardless of what it is. So we might as well set it up so it does it for the good.
So would you recommend that people like hire someone else to set up their environment and not tell them? It's like, you know, the minute I know I'm using the 9-inch plate.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about that is that it doesn't even, when you do it to yourself, you set it up, but you're not saying, you know, I'm eating a lot more fruit because I have a fruit bowl. So therefore, I'm going to reward myself. This seems to fall in the back of your mind because it wasn't that important of a decision to make in the first place to put a fruit bowl. So, if somebody did it for you and told you why they're doing it, it would influence you at that point. But 3 weeks later, it would be having the same impact and you wouldn't even think about it.
It's almost like you're telling people, like, don't make such a big deal about this.
Yeah. And, you know, and some people, we used to do these big clinic things, and people would kind of wring their hands about what the perfect change is to make. And it's like sometimes people thinking about exercise programs, like, oh, what would be the perfect sort of exercise? And for most people, just do something. And after you get moving, then we can start adding in the more perfect stuff. Just get going. And even when people say, give me your 10 best tips or whatever, it's just like, you know, I could, but I need to know a lot about you. And 10 tips would just be so overwhelming for you. You'd take zero away. Okay.
Right.
You know, like it's 1, 2, or 3 would be all you could do at a time. And once you master those, we can talk about the next step.
Right. So in some ways you are fighting against industry, because we're like roughly the American food industry produces maybe 2 to 3 times as many calories as we can possibly consume, and they need to move those calories, and the easiest way to move them is to get us to consume them. Have you seen any examples of food companies taking your research and like turning it on its head to actually increase consumption?
Oh, no, I'm not. And actually, I'm not fighting the food industry, because I think the food industry is going to be the solution in a lot of cases. And a great example of that is the 100-calorie pack that when back in 1995, I was able to convince some of these food companies that they'd make more money selling less food, they would kind of go, first of all, they'd kind of go, what? That doesn't make any sense. And actually, I recount this story in the introduction of the book Slim by Design. And they said, well, that doesn't make any sense. But then after they started thinking, they're like, yeah, that makes sense. If we can make more money, because we're not in this to make people fat, we're just in it to make a lot of money. And if we can sell less food but make more money, and it ended up being a great win. It ended up being a great win-win situation.
So I guess they all knew that you know, this, you can buy a 12-ounce can of Coke for the same price as the 3-liter bottle, right? That, like, oh, they're all $1.25, right? How does that work?
And with the soft drink companies, I don't know, because these are mainly the snack companies who I initially met with. Snack companies and Kellogg's also, who I initially met with, made the initial changes, the Nabisco, M&M Mars, and Kellogg's.
Right. And I know this, you know, because my business partner, Josh Lajani, used to weigh 420 pounds. And he talks about, you know, we'll talk about like serving sizes, like how to read a label. He says, no, when you're a fat guy, the serving size is the package. Right. Like, what, you know, it's the sleeve of Oreos, or it's the whole box of Oreos. It's not like, oh, look, it says 3 cookies is a serving size. So that what you did with the 100-calorie packs is you created like this visual and behavioral barrier. Like you can stop at 3 or 4 cookies, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you know, even that happened because of a mistake we had made in a research project. We were doing something in movie theaters, and we were giving people kind of bigger, different sized bags of snacks. And in one case, what happened was we were putting them in kind of like, you know, the Ziploc containers. Uh-huh. And what happened is that somebody bought, instead of the big ones, they bought really small ones. And we had all these people showing up. And so what we did is, instead of putting 440 calories in a big thing, we put 110 calories in 4 little ones and just gave those out. But we found that people didn't consume hardly any of them. They consumed 100 or 200 calories, but not the whole thing. And I said, well, maybe it's the fact that it's in these different sized bags. And that was actually, so it was actually an accident that caused us to initially say, wait a minute, this seems to work. And we follow up stuff. And so it kind of came up by an accident.
Well, I can see why your research has to be naturalistic, because if you're trying to be, quote, scientific and control every variable, and you discover that the size of the Ziploc bag that your purchasing manager brings to you makes a difference, you can get paralyzed into thinking like, we can't know anything. Like, you know, the Zodiac could make a difference, or the ambient temperature, you know, or a butterfly flapping its wings in another hemisphere could make a difference. It's like we have to find these naturalistic approaches, because there's always going to be, like, everything you add to it is going to affect replicability.
Yeah, I like that. The Zodiac could make a difference. That's very true. Yeah. That's, you know, so we had found a while back. So, like, if we take a look at just plate size, for instance, we found, so we find in all of our studies, and a bunch of other people find in the studies, that if you're in a real environment, you know, you serve about 20% more. But when these things tend to be done in labs, they tend to find a smaller difference. And so there's an interesting paper that was written a while back that looked at all these studies and says, well, the lesson for this is that plate size doesn't work very well if somebody is watching you while you eat and you know it. Huh. So that's why we need to put things in kind of, I think, in real environments, because that's where you find what really makes the big difference and what doesn't. And if it doesn't work in a real environment, it's not really a solution anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like the first thing I remember ever studying about social science. And this was probably in like high school, 10th grade, was the Hawthorne effect. Right.
Yeah, that's really cool, isn't it? Right. Yeah, I know. The first time I heard about it, I'm like, wow, that's crazy.
But I mean, we've, you know, so I guess they've known about this since the 50s. But a lot of social science ignores it. And basically, for people who don't know, the Hawthorne effect was like this, I think it was a Johnson's Control factory, where everything they did increased productivity. Even things that were like totally the opposite, like, oh, this increased productivity. This, and it turns out that the one factor was the employees knew they were being watched.
That's what increased productivity. Yeah. It's funny, you know, they turn the lights up, productivity goes up. They turn the lights down, productivity goes up. And it's just being watched that made the difference. Yeah.
So you're discovering, like, so I'm imagining places like Google and Facebook are obsessive about data. Like they've put your, I don't know, actually, I'm not positive. Does Facebook use your stuff as well? I know Google does.
Yeah, you know, we got a bunch of phone calls from Facebook. And what I did is I sent them the stuff that we had done for some of these other companies. And then I also sent them the chapter in Slim by Design that's about companies and about cafeterias. And so I think they might have just went ahead and implemented it themselves. Uh-huh. I mean, that would get them 60% there. I mean, if I'm there, I can go a little bit farther. But you know, right. If they just read the stuff and say, okay, we'll do that.
Right. And, well, I'm just curious whether you've gotten like for data from them, you know, because there's all these controversies about replicability and study design and yet, you know, we both know that you want to be a what did you say a pracademic.
Pracademic.
Yeah. So like if Google is keeping track, or you know, like I'm wondering if you have any corporate data or schools data about purchasing and consumption.
Oh. Yeah, tons and tons. I mean, we track, like we don't track all 27,000 schools, but we track at least a sample of 5,000 of them every year, see what works better and what seems to work a little bit less better and what people adjust to and things like that. Because that's what we find is really great is if it gets replicated actually in practice on a real cafeteria line, then we're like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But I mean, some of these things need an awful lot. If making a change needs a lot of monitoring, then it's a little bit hard to pick out to see if it's working or not. So, but it's the ones that the easier they are, the simpler they are, the 80-20 percent ones. Yeah, that's what's great to see work.
Right. So if you simply move where things are in the buffet line.
Yeah, I mean, there's an 11% chance that people are about 11% more likely to take whatever they see first. So, you know, put something healthier first.
Right. And by the way, I don't know, you know, so we're videotaping this, so people who are listening, but this is my water bottle. It's a half gallon. And this is totally because of your work, right? Because I would like, oh, I'll have a glass, like normal people would have a glass of water. And so great, I would drink a glass of water a day. And they're like, no, I want more. So I would get like a quart jar. Like, great, but how many glasses of water do I want to eat a day? I want to drink 8 glasses of water a day.
There's my water glass right there.
That's a nice big red one. And I'm like, so if I want to drink 8 glasses of water a day, why am I having a four glass jar on my desk? Why not just have the 8 glass jar? And that
have them all there? Yeah. That's exactly
and
right.
And I look at it. I'm looking at it right now. It's at four and a half. It's like you're not done. You got to keep going.
Yeah, what I want to do is I want you to have like one of those big gallon kind of milk jug like things that you can kind of like you know put around the drink like that like it's moonshine.
Yes. Yeah. And I believe that works for triceps as well. So now what I need is a refillable water. So like the soup bowl, I'm sure water would be very easy.
I think we could do that. That'd be a whole lot easier than chicken noodle soup.
That's awesome. So what are you, what's your research agenda for the next year or two? What are you looking at?
Yeah, well, so one cool set of stuff that we're just finishing up is looking at all these ways to reduce household food waste, the amount of food that we throw away. And we come up with some really, really kind of cool things. But then the other thing that we're working on that I think is so cool is now family feeding. And, you know, you get a lot of parents and they kind of feel like a lot of fun went out of their life when they had kids. They're not the cool 27-year-old they thought they were going to be. They always dreamed they'd be. you know, now they feel middle aged and they feel like they're doing nothing more than running a food service for their family or whatever. And so we're looking at all these cool studies that show small things that parents can do while feeding kids that get kids to eat healthier, but also end up being empowering to them. Either it makes them feel more creative, it makes them feel more appreciated, or it gets the kids to talk about something that's going on at school. And so we're looking at solutions like that. And I'm going into all these houses and talking to parents, and we're doing these big, huge scale studies now just to get all these good best practices about what people do that helps them feed their kids better, they think, but also they get some reward out of that that makes them feel like the person they want to be.
Yeah.
And not just like just a feeding machine.
Yeah. Can you give an example?
Yeah. I mean, one example would be we find that people who one thing is that the better your attitude is about something, okay, about, you know, it shifts just slightly how healthy you eat, how many calories you eat, and the mix. Okay, so we did a bunch of studies that showed that when we put people in positive moods versus just slightly negative moods, I mean, just a little, I mean, we're talking a little bit of a mood difference, that they ended up eating about 9% less if they're in a happy mood, but the mix of what they ate was also healthier. And, you know, you can say, well, what would be some things you can do? I mean, you can do something ridiculous, like, you know, like write a paragraph about why you're happy before you eat dinner, but who's going to do that? But instead, if you just do something very simple, is to say, okay, we're going to go around the table and we're all going to say one cool thing that happened to us today. Okay, Audrey, you start. But simply doing something like that is enough to change this mood a little bit. But it also lets mom and dad feel a little more connected because they hear something cool that Audrey did. Then Audrey and whoever else gets to hear something cool that happened to mom and dad.
Or that
maybe nothing really great that cool happened to mom and dad. Maybe they shouldn't have expectations that every day is going to be a miracle.
Great. So, because when you were first talking about this, I was thinking, like, you know, making faces out of fruit or.
Oh, yeah. No, this is stuff that's almost not fruit related. Yeah, it has an impact on food, but it has a bigger impact on you as a person.
Yeah, and again, this is stuff that I can imagine is sort of hard to replicate outside of a natural setting. If you say, you know, families that talk to each other, get along, look for positivity, eat better, like, how do you control for that? It's like, that's such a useful insight, and yet there's always going to be someone who can statistically disprove it, right, at some level.
Yeah. Well, and that's the danger of doing things in field exam situations, right? In field study situations, or doing things in the real world, is that there's all these kind of loose things, and you know, people can beat them up if they want to. But, I mean, that is, I think, the way that good discoveries happen and how good change happens.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, we can argue about, you know, the impact of carbohydrates or fats or trans fats or, you know, various things. We can have, like, scientific debates about that. I think it's going to be hard to tell someone, like, well, Neil, the risks, what if Brian's wrong about this? The risks of having a happy family are like,
or what?
Yeah, right.
Especially these simple things, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me a little bit of the work of Greg Walton, his WISE interventions, where they do these, like, little bitty things up at the, you know, sort of at the beginning of a semester that gets people to sort of iteratively change how they view and interact with the world. Like, if you're sitting down to a meal and you know that, okay, dinner with my family is this time where I get to express myself and I get reinforced for the best of who I am. Like, the cascading effects of that go far beyond, am I eating grapes instead of, you know, Oreos?
Yeah. And it might also help contribute to people not bringing their cell phone and spending the whole time texting Bobby or whatever underneath the table.
Right. Yeah, talk.
So I have three middle school girls. So that's why I'm using all these examples of real names.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as I'm thinking about it, like, your endless soup bowl is exactly what infinite scrolling is, right? There's always another thing. There's always something else on the Instagram or the Facebook feed.
It's true. It's true.
Right? Like
this Reddit never quit.
I mean, people can, you know, they just reverse engineer your findings. They can addict us pretty easily to stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, I know you got to go. I really thank you for taking the time. This has been, I've been looking forward to talking with you for years and years, because I've just been so inspired by the spirit of creativity that you bring to your work. Like when I read your books, it's like, boy, research can just be fun.
Well, you should have called earlier, and we could have done an interview years and years ago. Then,
oh well, I felt like I was, you know, punching above my weight class. So it's good to know that I can get you on the phone. So thank you for everything you do. So you have Mindless Eating, you have Slim by Design. Anything else?
Slim by Design. Well, those are the two that really really help people's lives like us. Mm-hmm. The other books are more like for researchers, like Marketing Nutrition, mm-hmm. or Asking Questions.
Okay.
Those are more like.
Great. So those are the books I'll read when I want to feel smarter than other people.
and become better rested.
Well, I'll have my my gallon jug in one hand and my academic textbook in the other.
I just love that vision of your hand, you like up on your shoulder like those, you know, those moonshine jugs. Uh-huh. Anyway, it's funny.
Awesome. Well, Brian Wansink, thank you so much for all the work you do, for the spirit you bring to inquiry, and for taking the time today.
Great. And, you know, if people are interested in more, they can go to the website healthierbydesign.org.
Healthier?
Healthierbydesign.org.
Great. I'll put that link in the show notes as well. Healthierbydesign.org. Brian Wansink, thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon. All right. Dr. Brian Wansink in the can, number 288. I hope you got some useful tidbits out of there. What about taking a moment right now and just jotting down one thing that he said that you're going to implement in your own life or in your family, in your home design, in your office design, to help you eat more in concert with your values, goals, and priorities? So if you liked this episode and you'd like to support the show, the easiest way to do it is simply go to Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, and write a review. Give us some stars. That really helps us get noticed by the gods of podcast search engines so that more people can find the podcast and hear the message of a happy, healthy, joyful, environmentally responsible, plant-based life. And of course, you can also become a patron of the show, help defray the costs so that I can continue to attract great guests, upgrade the audio, maybe even do some travel podcasting. Your support means a great deal from a very tangible perspective. And also psychologically, knowing that there's people out there who value this makes it a lot easier for me to get up every morning and do the work that I do, because I do it in a vacuum. I do it in my own little space. In my own little office, occasionally I'm on the phone or on Skype with people, but mostly this is like writing. I'm by myself, and so getting the feedback in terms of dollars and cents is very, very powerful. It's a great motivator and a great reminder that what I'm doing matters in the world somewhere, somehow. All right, if you're new to this show, you can catch up on 287 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. So a lot of you have been wondering how we've been doing with Hurricane Florence bearing down on us. The answer is, psychologically, I was a mess for about a week, from when I first heard that it was coming on Monday to when I went to Lowe's and bought $700 worth of plywood and cut it so I could cover the windows, to then finding out on Wednesday and Thursday that it was probably going to miss us, but then still seeing about 12 inches of rain and thunderstorms and wind and having roads closed all around us. And in the middle of all that, really agonizing over whether I could go to the Plantrician conference in San Diego, which I ended up not going to. And I was really sad because there were so many people, especially from Australia, that I otherwise don't know when I'm going to meet, who are there, who are sending me videos and pictures. And I was just sort of stuck at home with intermittent power outages and not enough bad weather to make me feel really good about my decision. But there you have it. But the answer is the house is standing. We lost a couple of trees in the back, but nothing landed on our house or our farm equipment or our vehicles or anything that we care deeply about. It's all rebuildable. And our hearts go out to all the people around us in North Carolina who are not so lucky. In garden news, we haven't done much in the garden. We now walk there without getting stuck in the mud. We've got some flats of winter greens going in, kale, collards, trying to keep the bunnies and the groundhogs out so that we can get some too. In running news, I am seriously considering going back to Baton Rouge for the Louisiana Marathon in January, which would give me something to shoot for to see if I can Boston qualify at a 3-hour, 30-minute pace. So that's what I'm probably going to be training for starting in a couple of weeks. Okay, so let's say thank you first to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use Sabali Dawn, the Dance of Peace, as the theme music for this show. Check out willridenour.com. That's R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R, willridenour.com, for more of his beautiful music and to see if he'll be playing anywhere near you. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Got a couple of new ones this week, so let's see how long it takes to say them. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Diston, Brittany Porter, Dominic Marrow, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hathaway, Mary Jane Wheeler, Alan Kennedy, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Burns, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Volnowski, wow, I didn't do that very well. Tina Sharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Volnowski, David Isaac, The Mysterious, Michelle X, Elspeth Thelvin, Victoria Dolman, Ovalea Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina, Julianne Rollins, Drew Dolnick, Sarah Durkis, Ron Sturkis, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Patterson, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby. Janet, thank you for upping your pledge. I got a book on the way to you as soon as I can get out of the driveway into the post office. Claire Adams, Tom Fronzek, Jeanette Benham, Gail Lasser, David Donahue, Blair Seibert, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Ruth Ann Funderburk, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, the equally mysterious Tracy Z, Alicia Lemus, Rebecca Hughes, Val Linneman, Rhymes with Cinnamon, Nick Harper, Stephanie Holmes, Nothing, Martha Berner, Nicole Ramsey, Susan Alma, Molly Levine, the inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, the Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Berry, Heather Morgan, Ashley Corcoran, Kelly Machia, Dean Norton, Bonnie Lynch, A Plant, Happy Organ, Sabina Kurtzels, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Copel, Shell Rutledge, Julian Watton, Breed O'Connell, Brian Sheridan, Shannon Hirschman, Kate Rolls, Linda Ayat, Julie Lang, Holm, Hedegaard, Isa Fusenwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Aviva Lyle, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski, Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Morani, Karen, Joe Crabtree, Tanya Lewis, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Kelly Baker, Miracle Ann, Jesse Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Valerie Peltier, Peter W. Evans, Colleen Harrison, Justine Dillard, Joshua Sommermeyer, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Valerie Hummel, Deb Cassia, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty Marti Martino, and Mike and Donna Kartz for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for this week. As always, be well, my friends. Right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song Sabali Dawn, the Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Diston, Brittany Porter, Dominic Marrow, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hathaway, Mary Jean Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Vizek, The Mysterious, Michelle X, Elspeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Rhymes with Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Pedersen, Janet Selby, Care Adams, Tom Fronzek, Jeanette Benham, Gail Lasser, David Donahue, Blair Seibert, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carol Argentati, Jody Friesner, Ruth Ann Funderburk, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, the equally mysterious Tracy Z, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Rebecca Hughes, Val Linneman, Rhymes with Cinnamon, Nick Harper, Martha Bergner, Susan Amon, Molly Levine, the inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, the Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Kelly Machia, Deanne Norton, Bonnie Lynch, Plant Happy Oregon, Sabina Kurtzels, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Copel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Shannon Hirschman, Linda Ayat, Holm Hedegaard, Isa Tuzuwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Orlikowski of Plant Powered for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Morani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Tanya Lewis, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Valerie Peltier, Peter W. Evans, Colleen Harrison, Justine Divitt, Joshua Sommermeyer, Dennis Bird, Darmy Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Valerie Hummel, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan McCorney, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bill Brielf, Gunter Schmidt, Marjorie Lewis, Kelly Molden, Trisha Adams, Ian Kramer, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bashver, Gunmarie Hagen, Tracy Gullish, Laura Heedon, Meg from Mama Says, Rochelle Kennedy, Diana Goldman, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, Holly Butler, Diana, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Parham Ganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Olga Sidoruska, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught, Abedible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, and Danielle Roberts for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for today. As always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize, all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.